Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. Today we're talking about Martin McDonagh's polarizing new movie, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
In the opening moments of the film, Mildred Hayes contemplates three empty billboards. Soon, Mildred, played by Frances McDormand, pays to cover them with a message.
The message is that local police have failed to solve the murder of her daughter. What follows is a story about her anger and grief, but also about the police chief, played by Woody Harrelson, and a vicious, racist officer, played by Sam Rockwell.
Three Billboards also stars John Hawkes, Lucas Hedges, Caleb Landry-Jones, and Abby Cornish. And we're all going to have a chat about it this week. I'm Stephen Thompson of NPR Music.
Also with us is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And joining us from NPR's Code Switch team is our friend Gene Demby. Hey, buddy.
Hey, homie.
So Gene and I have both expressed a lot of feelings about this movie on Twitter already. So I'm going to start with Stephen and Glenn. Stephen, where did you come down on Three Billboards?
My initial take was that it was a kind of B-grade Coen Brothers, that it was really going for a Coen Brothers vibe of dark comedy. It has that Carter Burwell score. It stars Frances McDormand, who was in Fargo. There are a lot of ingredients that say Coen Brothers and also ingredients that say very dark comedy. And on some level, some of the darkly comedic elements I was there for, but as this movie went along, I found myself increasingly frustrated with it. I think that in addition to some of the racial politics, which we will get into,
to say the least,
I also found myself on a larger scale very frustrated with the feeling that there was no one to root for, that there was no one who was really behaving in a way that I could get behind, nobody who was really motivated to do the right thing for the right reasons. And the movie's point of view on that was very slippery. I found it to be very, very jumbled, but also like your kind of anti-hero Frances McDormand character who's tormenting the police, who deserve to be tormented, but she's tormenting them for all the wrong reasons. The Sam Rockwell cop character, he gets a redemption arc that is horrifyingly undeserved. So we see him brutalize someone, and we hear reference to him having tortured someone in custody, tortured a black person. It is straight up said. And first he's treated as this kind of weirdly harmless, folksy rube.
Mm-hmm.
And then over time, he's given a sort of redemption arc.
Oh, it's weird.
That is beyond undeserved. I've seen some undeserved redemption arcs in movies.
Yeah.
But this movie, whose side am I supposed to be on? This movie has gotten very, very good reviews. I was extremely frustrated with it.
Yeah. How about you, Glenn?
I agree, Stephen, that this movie's point of view is a little muddy. I like Martin McDonagh. He's an Irish director, playwright, writer. I like In Bruges, his first film, a lot. This is his third. Seven Psychopaths, I think, took a bit of a nosedive. But he appeals, in general, to the 14-year-old boy in me who's kind of fascinated by violence. I think of him as sort of not necessarily Bargain Basement Coen, but Bargain Basement Tarantino. Mm. Or at least, actually, you know what? You know what? Tarantino has a glibness to him. All of his stuff is riffing on cinema. Mm-hmm. And at least in his plays especially, McDonagh is riffing on life.
Mm-hmm.
But here, you know, film art is a moral medium. We are supposed to kind of line up behind somebody. And when you have Frances McDormand as the avenging angel, the Greek fury in this movie, we are conditioned by years and years of art to know that that's a bad thing, that she is digging her own grave, that... And yet, you don't know where she's coming out. The film sides with her and then doesn't. I went into this film expecting a much more comedic film. Blackly comedic, sure, but still a darkly comedic film. And what I got when it was, you know, touching on, as the inciting incident, a brutal rape and murder, it felt like it was drafting on that energy, that emotional energy, you know, taking energy, taking narrative momentum from that, which is not this movie's fault. I mean, like this, like that is endemic to culture. Mm-hmm. But it did feel disingenuous. I came away with it not having a strong reaction to it at all. It was a movie that I saw. It was a movie I saw several weeks ago. I remember being mystified not by the praise it got, but by the praise specifically that Frances McDormand got, because she's kind of one note here. She's only given the one thing to do, and the people around her are constantly telling her that she's wrong, but she doesn't veer from that. And I don't want to get into it, but I think the ending of the film, which is supposed to resolve something, is a big, big narrative cop-out.
Yeah.
But I didn't have a strong reaction.
Yeah.
Unlike the folks in this room.
Yeah. So I'm going to let Gene bring this home in a minute. But my reaction to this film, I was very much there for the film I thought it was in the first few minutes, right? Because I really do think looking at her grief and where she's supposed to go with it and how to handle it, and the fact that her grief is coming out as rage,
right.
Mm-hmm. To me is a really interesting thing to think about. But it almost immediately, there's a very early scene. This entire discussion is somewhat more spoilery than we would normally be. It's just unavoidable, and I don't think the movie really turns on its surprises. Mm-hmm. But very early on, you have a scene in which she is talking to Woody Harrelson as the police chief. And very quickly, two things are efficiently established. A, her anger is misplaced because they've done everything they can. The other is he is sick. And both of those things come together to establish very early she is in the wrong, her anger is misplaced, she shouldn't be acting like this. And for me, the entire rest of the movie becomes about her recognizing the consequences of her anger and her behavior, the consequences for her son, the consequences for Woody Harrelson, the consequences for Woody Harrelson's wife, who is weirdly Abby Cornish for no reason. She's like a very young Australian beautiful woman who looks like a model, but nobody ever asks why does he have this much younger Australian wife. It's not clear what her accent is at several different places, but the consequences for the guy that's played by Caleb Landry Jones kind of intersects with her early in the film. The consequences of her behavior on him are explored. Even the consequences of her behavior on her abusive ex-husband are explored. So the whole thing to me is about her realizing my anger is bad for other people and hurts other people, so I have to learn to get past it. Nobody else in the movie, to me, is confronted with the consequences of their actions. Woody Harrelson definitely isn't.
No.
Sam Rockwell, there are people who will tell you that he is, but if you really look at the movie, those are not consequences of his actions, and I won't spoil what they are, but go back and think about, are those really consequences of his bad actions? They are not. But in addition to all of that, I just didn't think it was very good. I thought it turns way too much on coincidence and kind of weird people who pop up and nothing happens with them. And I think this is one of Gene's complaints that he will get into. People pop up kind of to have a moral effect on the story, but they don't do anything. And when you bring a lot of this stuff up, what you get back is a lot of, like, it's nuanced.
Ugh.
I do not think that Sam Rockwell character is nuanced at all. Ooh. He is, to me, a complete cliche. Mm. If you have really never seen brutal, horrible men who later you find out have some sadness that makes them that way, if you really think that's nuance at a high level, then you have seen a very different slice of culture than I have. Now, having said all that.
You also forgot the consequences that her rage has for Peter Dinklage.
Oh, God. Yeah, okay, and this is, and I'll say one more thing before I hand it over to Gene. But when Glenn talks about wanting comedic elements, to me, the vast majority of the things that are supposed to be comedic in this movie are the socially kind of like the oh boy moment of hearing somebody use a racial slur. So the comedic elements to me, most of the stuff that I thought was supposed to be comedic, at least in a kind of a screenplay way, a dialogue way, was dumb anyway.
Let me just say that when I see Sam Rockwell in a trailer doing this accent, I do not expect a Greek melodrama, which is kind of what they're reaching for.
No, I know. All right. So, Gene, you talked about this movie on Twitter from the moment that you saw it, basically.
I was so amped to see this movie. So I was like, yo, let's go. It's got 94% on Rotten Tomatoes. My girlfriend and I went to see it, and we came out of it like, my girlfriend tweeted after this movie, if you like this movie, we cannot be friends. I don't remember the last time I hated a movie this much. Actually, I do. It was Crash.
Good. Yeah, right.
The way this movie treats racism, right, is almost like a character beat, right? This is a cop who we know, because a bunch of people have said that he tortured black people, right? The big set piece, which I won't ruin, but like in the big set piece, there's a big one-shot artsy set piece, a score to indie music, in which another character has a very, very terrible encounter with this police officer. And this police officer gets this redemption arc. This police officer throws a black person in jail, who he basically disappears from the movie for most of the movie, then reappears. She emerges none the worse for wear. And she's smiling and she's like, Mildred, are you okay? Like, oh, I was just in jail for 3 weeks. But girl, what's wrong with you? You know what I mean?
And like, there's like one line where she's like, oh, they threw the whole thing out. And it's like, wait, what? You... What?
Yeah, she wasn't angry. There's a character played by Clark Peters whose blackness is literally just a shorthand for his like moral authority, right? Mm-hmm. Like he doesn't do anything in this film outside of like supposedly, like, I mean, they're using his blackness as a shorthand to contrast him with the rest of the police department.
Right.
And they do nothing with that.
And you're supposed to have that moment of being like, oh, he's in trouble now.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the new guy is a black guy. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, that doesn't, you know, go ahead.
But in a world in which like the interiority of white police officers, abusive white police officers takes precedence, like in a real way, like takes precedence over the like brutality they visit on people, right? I mean, when we see these cases in real life, in Missouri, in Ferguson, right? Mm-hmm. The defense that police officers can use or that they use is that I was fearful for my life, right? And so this movie does this thing where it turns the stakes, the real sort of moral stakes or the stakes of the movie center on what's happening in Sam Rockwell's heart, right? Like, you know, he lives with his mama, right? And he's sort of the sad sack. Who cares? You know what I mean? Like, that's not important. Like, he's visited real agony on a lot of people. And it's treated as just like this sort of generic, he's just a generic bad guy, right?
Right.
The abusive husband is treated as a generic bad guy. I'm just shocked that so many people like this movie so much because there's so much structurally wrong with it. But there's so much like morally wrong with it. And I'm not somebody who's like, it's sort of transgressive politics, if you want to call it that, or things that are disqualifying. But I think from what I've read of interviews with McDonough after this, like, he doesn't get these particular physics of American racism, and he's not interested in them. He's like, oh, well, America's not more racist than any place else. But that's not the question. The question is whether there are specific, you know, dimensions and dynamics in American racism that make an encounter between a black person and a white cop who is beaten up a lot, like, literally every black person, not just every black person, every person in the movie who meets Sam Rockwell's character comments on the fact that he is a racist, abusive cop, mm-hmm. right? And so that's not a thing you can sort of, like, brush aside as, like, this weird character note, you know what I mean? You have to take that seriously. You have to take
right.
the fact this other guy is a wife beater seriously.
Right.
Right. right. And when you talk about transgressive politics, the thing that I think is interesting about this movie is that very often when you raise the way that a movie engages with race or that a movie engages with domestic violence, mm-hmm. the responses that you get will be like, not everything is politics. It's a movie. You have to take it on its own terms, blah, blah, blah. This movie has made a specific choice to use a racist police officer mm-hmm. and the fact of a racist police officer as a story element and to use domestic abuse as a story
That's
element.
Right.
Once you do that, you can't say, like, but you can't evaluate the way that I'm doing it and what I'm using it to say. And it's not so much like it would be facile to be like, I don't want to see domestic violence because yeah, that's reality. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is the domestic violence is processed by the character and used by the movie in such a weird way. And when you talk about the scene, the kind of big set piece where Sam Rockwell does violence to another character, the thing that infuriated me about that scene is it is set, like you said, to this indie song, which as filmmaking, the use of an indie song to score that scene makes your perspective his sad feelings. Mm-hmm. And once you choose to score a scene of brutality with a song that cues sad feelings as what's going on in this scene, you are recentering that entire scene on the feelings of the police officer as he's doing it. And it's not necessarily that you can't examine the feelings of the police officer, but you have to do that in a really thoughtful way.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that she processes domestic violence is so glib in this way. And I understand that a real person in that situation might do that.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't, they don't do anything with it. It doesn't seem to have a point of view about that fact. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Glenn.
No, but that's it. I mean, cinematically, this film made a choice to not depict the act of brutal rape and murder that kicks the film off, or at least the events of the film off. And I've seen reviews saying, well, it's not depicted. As if that's a good thing.
Mm.
I would argue that's the insidious thing. That's the thing that makes it conceptual and not visceral. The same thing for the fact that this guy has tortured a black person or possibly more. That is
off-screen.
Backstory.
Off-screen. Mm-hmm.
That is off screen. And so what we see is an act of domestic violence, which looks very like acts of domestic violence we've seen on screen before, and somebody another act of violence, mm-hmm. which is among white people.
Every time we see her ex-husband's new girlfriend, who's mm-hmm. 19 years old, right, and she's like supposedly played as a ditz. Every time we see her, you're thinking like this person is in danger, right?
Save this person,
absolutely, right? And but they play her like as just like, oh, she's like a ditzy airhead, right? And she's supposed to, and we're supposed to feel like, oh, what an idiot, right? But it's like, oh, she's in mortal danger.
I mean, I think of her as one of the characters that kind of float into this movie on the wind and out as quickly as they came, mm-hmm. that almost feel like in the editing of this movie, I wonder if in the editing of this movie, several of these characters had kind of longer, richer roles in this movie, because there are so many characters who just kind of disappear or show up and have a dramatic moment that is feels entirely unearned, mm-hmm. that the movie then does nothing with. There's just the secondary characters in this film are so befuddling to me. We haven't even talked, I don't think, about the guy who kind of rolls in as a figure of menace and with no discernible motivation.
Yeah. And without spoiling the ending, I think you can say it's not very satisfying the way they ultimately deal with him either.
Right.
I think that, you know, when you look at this movie, yeah, you can say whatever you want about Sam Rockwell. The portrait of the Woody Harrelson character is not nuanced in the slightest. No. And there is no examination whatsoever what it means that he is allowing this brutal, racist police officer to remain a police officer and to sort of mentor and encourage and parent him. Mm-hmm. Like, that says something about who you are. You can't just be like, and then he's a good old guy.
There's an aside where he says, like I think he says, like, alleged torture, right? Or where he sort of corrects him. It's like, yo, like, what are we doing?
And
right
that's
now?
Played to me for a laugh.
It is played for a laugh.
Where he's
right.
kind of like, it's not proven that he did right. that. Like, yeah. it's not funny. Like, what are you talking about? Like, you keeping a, I don't know. Maybe I'm just not in the mood for this.
You know, it's funny, Linda. You just said something that was the first thing written down in my notes and actually circled it here. First thing I said about this movie, boy, I don't know.
I mean, they don't even treat her grief and rage as a like a real thing. They're like, oh, but that was when your teenage daughter was raped and murdered mm-hmm. and set on fire, right? That was 7 months ago. Mm-hmm. Why are you so upset? You would think that there would be other people in the town who would understand her grief
yes!
and rage, right?
Did not like yeah. it. Anyway, but it is there are a lot of people who really love it, including some very smart people I know. And I know Gene's
it's disqualifying. I mean, like,
no,
you're
I
disqualifying 94% of the critics on Rotten Tomatoes.
I mean, honestly, and that's like a whole different conversation we can have about like who the critical establishment is and what they look
that's
like.
Fair.
But there is, I imagine if you have a more diverse, if you have a critical establishment that has more women and more brown people in it, right, in prominent critical positions, then the 94% that this has on Rotten Tomatoes is not there. I mean, I just don't think you can play around with domestic violence. Or you, those are subject matter areas. Or that's just subject matter that you have to take seriously.
Yeah. And that's not to say that all women would agree with
sure,
me
of course.
Or that all right. brown people would agree. It's just to say if you have a different mix,
right.
you're more likely to find, you know, somebody within that mix who sees, you know, through the, who sees it through a slightly different lens.
Absolutely. Yeah.
This movie needed to have a much surer hand.
Yeah.
By keeping the torture abstract in the beginning mm-hmm. as backstory, you have a lot of the critical community who are treating it as a laugh line. As
yeah.
like a, as and if the critic pool was more diverse, that would not be the case.
Absolutely.
That
yeah.
would not be the case.
I think mm-hmm. that's right. But I will be extremely curious to hear what you think about Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH. And when we come back, it is going to be time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Artifact Uprising, turning your digital photos into premium quality photo books, frames, calendars, and more. Known for their elevated design and thoughtfully sourced materials, Artifact Uprising is dedicated to honoring the meaningful in your life. So this holiday season, they're giving NPR listeners 10% off holiday photo gifts they'll enjoy year-round with the promo code HAPPYHOUR at artifactuprising.com/happyhour. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Artifact Uprising, turning your digital photos into premium quality photo books, frames, calendars, and more. known for their elevated design and thoughtfully sourced materials. Artifact Uprising is dedicated to honoring the meaningful in your life. So this holiday season, they're giving NPR listeners 10% off holiday photo gifts they'll enjoy year-round with the promo code HAPPYHOUR at artifactuprising.com/happyhour.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Patton Oswalt Annihilation is a new special on Netflix. We've been hearing a lot about it. There's a wonderful interview with him on Fresh Air. This has been getting a lot of conversation. I finally sat down and watched it. As most people know, Patton Oswalt lost his wife and has grieved very publicly, not only in social media, but more recently in his act. And this special on Netflix captures a lot of that. And I went into it bracing for something very devastating and coming in like there will be jokes, but there will be many, many tears and we're going to hunker down. And I was so impressed with what a light touch he brings into it. And it brings in this very kind of moral, but there's also all these silly asides along the way that keep it consistent with a lot of the stuff he does. I mean, there's a whole silly bit where he does a bunch of crowd work. There's a very, very, very funny bit about an old woman on an airplane and just kind of these like silly asides and then digressions into processing his grief with his daughter. I found it really pleasing and beautiful with a very lovely kind of message at the end of it. It's a very, very nice special. It's called Annihilation, Patton Oswalt on Netflix.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
You know what I hate is Christmas cheer. Cheer in general, but Christmas cheer in particular, because its chief vector, its delivery system, the means by which it invades the host, is Christmas music. And Christmas music is inescapable.
I know where you're going.
It is relentless. It is repetitive. It is. And when people say, oh, it's tradition, you know what I say when I hear that? I say, get some new ideas. How about some new ideas? Can nothing be fresh? Can nothing be new? Do we really need to hear Silver Bells again? Somebody's latest take on it. Stephen, what's the most recent, like, new Christmas standard? Is it All I Want,
for Christmas okay. Is You, yeah. 1994, I think.
There's a new sheriff in town. Jessica, hit me once. Christmas is waiting for you in the homes. It's waiting for all of us. It's lurking. That is Sia's from Every Day is Christmas, her album. That is Candy Cane Lane. The other songs on this amazing album are Christmas is Waiting, the line, Christmas is Waiting, Santa's Coming for Us. Yes, he is. And Puppies Are Forever, which is about how don't give a puppy on Christmas because, you know, it grows up. So the specter of dog death hangs over that song. It is so much fun and it is so great. And just not for nothing, the lyric that immediately precedes what I just played is something about Rudolph. We can dance. He can prance. Ain't no can'ts, because here everything is possible. And I'm just going to put it out here now. Queerest Christmas song lyric ever. You had a good run, Don We Now Our Gay Apparel, but your reign is over because that is the queerest lyric ever. That is Sia's Every Day is Christmas. Every song's great, but that is Candy Cane Lane.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Gene Demby, what is making you happy this week?
Oh, so what's making me happy this week is A Big Mouth, which everyone loves. Mm-hmm. It's filthy. It's silly.
And but remind people what it is if they don't know.
It's this cartoon on Netflix. It's done by Nick Kroll. He plays this teenage boy. His best friend is played by John Mulaney. But the episode I want people to watch is so, so good. It's called Girls Are Horny Too. And it is about the main character, Jess, and her sort of like understanding that she has a
little beat guess about what it's about.
And as an aside, her like male friends coming to understand that women have libidos, but also like her specific coming to understand like what her body does, is both really, really dirty and really, really smart. And also, more importantly, it's just funny as hell. So if you get a chance to watch Girls Are Horny Too, from Big Mouth. Please do that.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Big Mouth.
Yeah.
Thank you, Gene Demby. Mm-hmm. I am going to go with the Hari Kondabolu special,
yes.
The Problem with Apu.
Shout out to Hari.
He is a big fan of The Simpsons, has loved The Simpsons for a long time, talks about how influential they are, but has always been troubled by Apu,
mm-hmm.
And goes into a whole... and it's not too long. It's like a 45-minute documentary. And he goes into an examination of how when he was growing up, the only kind of South Asian person that he saw on television was Apu,
mm-hmm.
done by Hank Azaria, a white guy, doing what Hank Azaria acknowledges is kind of a send-up of, in part, a white Peter Sellers doing the voice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very... problematic in a bunch of ways, right. Just off the bat.
Peter Sellers doing a Peter Sellers character that was in brownface.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So he kind of goes through and he talks to a bunch of different people. And there's so much good conversation in this documentary about the conflict that people feel where they're like, on the one hand, people like The Simpsons, but on the other hand, they really are super turned off by this. And he also throws in a little bit of a Michael Morian trying to get an interview with Hank Azaria mm-hmm. thing, which is quite funny. But one of the things I really like about it is he has these kind of casual conversations with guys like Cal Penn and Hasan Minhaj mm-hmm. and Pranana Charla, and they just chat about how they feel about this stuff in comedy. And it was really cool. It's really fascinating. It, as I said, it's not too long. The Problem with Apu, you can get it on True TV. It's streaming. Mm-hmm. I think it's also on Amazon and some of the other services.
And Hari also came on the Code Switch podcast. He was our guest on our live show a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we have one more thing before we go that we are very excited about. There is a new way to support us and support your local station. I know that a lot of you ask us, how do I support Pop Culture Happy Hour? And we tell you, give to your local station. But sometimes, you know, if you are a person who listens to podcasts, it can be tough to see that tight connection. The good news for you and for us is that there's now an opportunity for you to give to your local station, but on behalf of your love of our show, which we love and we hope you love. If you go to donate.npr.org/happy, you will get an opportunity to support your local station, but you will also show your appreciation for us. At the same time, if you would like to tweet about your donation and use the hashtag #WhyPublicRadio and maybe tag us in that tweet, you know, people tag us in a wide variety of tweets. This would be a great one to tag us in. Then we will know that that you supported public radio and you support us. So again, donate.npr.org/happy and tag us at PCHH with the hashtag #WhyPublicRadio and tell us what it does for you. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at @NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at @IDislikeSteven. You can follow Glenn at @GHWeldon and Gene at @GEEDEE215. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at @Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello, Come In, provides our in and out music, which you're bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you guys so much for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.